All right, welcome, welcome to another episode of the Creditor Podcast. I'm your host, Chase Palmieri, and with me today is Fiona McDonald. And Fiona is an award-winning science reporter who became CEO of Science Alert in 2017. And Science Alert, for those of you that don't know, is one of the most popular science news sites in the world right now with over 15 million monthly readers. Fiona, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be on.
Yeah, thank you. And one of the areas that I wanted to start with, because what you do at Science Alert is a little bit different than mainstream journalists who kind of cover whatever is newsworthy that day. You guys really focus on science-based journalism. And so just to kind of start, I was wondering if you could give the media as a whole two different grades. One grade for how the science reporting has been across mainstream media before the pandemic, and then one grade for how you think that they managed to maybe step up or change their science-based reporting during the pandemic.
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I think it's hard to say because mainstream media, I suppose, it's like two big categories. You have some really high quality media outlets, like you've got the New York Times, the Atlantic, the Washington Post, who are mainstream, but they cover science in a beautiful, beautiful way. And then you've got, maybe lesser, more tabloid focused mainstream media who also cover science, but not in such an amazing way. So I would give some of the higher quality media outlets an A before and after the pandemic. Some of the ones I mentioned before have always done a stellar job. But I think some of the other publications who are a little more tabloid focused, yeah, maybe a C or a D pre-pandemic. And I think they've lifted their game a little bit. I think everyone since the pandemic has really become aware of the importance of science news and facts and accuracy and not letting the story get in the way of the facts. So I do think people have lifted their game. And now I think a lot of the health coverage is sitting at a B. I still think that especially with a lot of tabloid mainstream media, there is a lot of coverage of COVID-related studies that aren't applicable to humans as yet. And we've been really careful since the pandemic to make sure we're not covering anything in preprint that is actionable as health advice, because that's when you start getting into trouble and recommending treatments and not even recommending treatments, but even writing about treatments in a way that's not founded as yet. Like there's a lot of studies that have been done in labs and in mice and maybe really preliminary work in humans. And I think that some mainstream media have done a great job at filtering out what's important and what isn't. But then you sometimes I'll log in the morning and I'll see some tabloid media have just like run with some obscure, new antibody treatment is really great. And again, kind of hyping it up. And you're like, actually, that was a really tiny trial. And I'm not sure that it's even worthy of coverage. So yeah, I think some great publications and A, always stellar work. It's lovely to see. And then, yeah. Tabloids have lifted their game a little bit, but I would still say, yeah, B or C, B minus.
Yeah, I think I'd have to agree. It does seem like across the board, the outlets that are covering, used to covering mainstream news have kind of upped their game for science coverage. Do you think that that's just kind of a side effect of this life and death coverage? Or do you think that they actually went out at the beginning of the pandemic and started hiring some more science-based journalists?
I don't think that's the case. I don't know. I can't say for sure. Actually, I'm not too sure. I think if anything, a lot of mainstream media seem to let people go at the start of the pandemic. So I doubt that. I don't think that many people were hiring really highly specialized science journalists, but I do think it's the awareness. I think that, when we started Science Alert, it was 2006, around 2005, 2006. And science was such a not mainstream novelty. Like no one covered science. Maybe the New York Times in the print issue would have like a paragraph on a science story, but you had to really go to the niche publications. But since then we've seen such a change, like with the internet and Facebook, science has become very trendy. So pre-pandemic, I think a lot of tabloid mainstream media would jump on science because it is exciting and it's cool and it can get a lot of clicks if it's a really interesting story. And I think they just didn't take it seriously. They were like, oh, let's have any hack journalist churning it out. It's about space. Like what can go wrong? It doesn't really matter. Or red wine's great for you. Chocolate's great for you. It was sort of not such high stakes. So I think it was treated a bit like a novelty you'd put the night editor on, or like the youngest inexperienced journalist, just to bash out some science stories. But obviously with the pandemic, it was life or death. And, you know, people had to take it so seriously. And the information you give to the public, you know, people really are looking for trusted information at the moment. They don't want to hear any more conspiracies or their friends' opinions, or like they really want to know what the scientists are saying. So I think that it's just been taken a little bit more seriously because people have realized actually, yeah, for this point in time, science is kind of the main leading story, and it's not just a kind of fun thing to add onto the side.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. How big is the Science Alert team right now?
We have 11 of us. So we have myself and our founder, Chris, who's the CTO, COO. And then we have a managing editor, Signe, our deputy editor, Pete. And we have like four to five writers, depending on the day, a couple of freelancers, and then some fact checkers. So yeah, it's a pretty small team, and we're all based, as you can tell from my accent, I'm in Australia. We started in Australia. Most of us are here in Australia, but we have a writer in the UK and two writers in the Washington State area.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask about that. How is reporting from Australia, which isn't, you know, your mainstream traditional news media hub, how is that different? Does it provide you a little bit more flexibility in some ways?
We've had issues. So when we started, again, we founded back in like 2006, and we planned to be quite Australian focused. We were like, yeah, there's no one really covering Australian news. And then as soon as we launched on Facebook and kind of made the page more global focused, we realized that like there actually was this global appetite for science news, and we've sort of become a lot more world focused. And since then, we're a .com domain. We're not a .com.au domain. And 70% of our readers are now in the United States. So it's interesting. We have advantages in some ways with the time zone, because sometimes stuff that's happening overnight in the States, we'll get it first. And all the press releases that come out, we often have a chance to write them first. At the same time though, anything that breaks during the US day, we wake up to. So we're on the back foot a little bit. And we do have an editor and a writer in the US, but it's not the full team. Like we don't have fact checkers over there and stuff. So it's, yeah, there are pros and cons. It is good though. I mean, we all work from home, even pre-pandemic. We've all been a remote team. We all work on Zoom and Slack, and that's kind of our go-tos. So we luckily didn't have to change life that much during the pandemic, and I think that's been an advantage. And yeah, sometimes the time zone is an advantage, but also we'll have a breaking story, and you know, there'll be times when we get this great story in and we'd call up for quotes and it's the middle of the night in the States and we just can't get any. So yeah, there's also disadvantages.
Yeah, and you actually became the CEO in 2017, but before that I think you were the lead editor.
Writer and a leader. I wasn't a founder, but I've been with the team, with the company, since like a few months after it started. So I'd studied science, I did my honors year and realized I didn't want to work in the lab, and so then I went back and did like a journalism 1 year degree. And I, during that degree, I reached out to Chris, the founder, and was like, hey, can I intern with you guys? I need to do an internship. But at the same time, I was like working two jobs to pay for uni. So I had to do a virtual one. So I was like, Science Lab would be perfect. So I started out doing everything, just like uploading some press releases, which is what we did at the beginning, writing headlines. And then when we started writing our own content, I was writing articles. But I have done everything. I've fact checked, I've edited it. And I think that's been really, really useful. I've also, you know, like done a little bit of the ad management, some of the tech stuff. And I think that has been really pivotal in taking over CEO, because I totally have an overview of like everyone's role on the team and how challenging it is. Because as you said earlier on, like it is, being science journalists have a hard job, because every, you know, truth is important in all journalism, but we have to be experts in like every field. And pretty much everyone on the team has a science background. If they haven't studied science, they've worked quite heavily in science or tech. But you know, we're not, it's no way you can have an expert in everything. So I studied zoology at uni. That was my major, and now I've had to write stories on quantum physics and fact check stories on medical research. And yeah, and our voice at Science Lab, we're always trying to be like that smart friend who tells you cool facts that you can share at the dinner table. So we have to sort of have that expert voice. So like you'll have a short story, but it's involved three of us like reading like four papers on quantum physics and deep diving into YouTube videos on how quantum entanglement works. Yeah, so it can be tough. And I think it's good. I think the team is grateful. They have a CEO that appreciates that it can be really tough because, yeah.
Yeah, they always say that the CEO should be able to do every little job in the company so that they know, you know, how the machine works. Otherwise, yeah, you can't really lead a team if you don't know how it really works in the operations. So that's cool. I was curious, actually, because you just brought it up, that sometimes you have to go into these fields that you're not necessarily an expert at to cover. When you're hiring your staff of journalists, do you try to hire somebody who's great on genetics and somebody who's great on physics and somebody who's great on, you know, drugs and pharmaceuticals and vaccines? How does the balance work?
Yeah, we don't have like a strict criteria where we're like, oh, the next person we hire has to be in genetics or whatever, but it's definitely an asset and we try and have balance. So we have Michelle Starr. She's like a really great space writer, astronomy writer who writes for us. And we're super lucky because she's like tapped into the astronomy community and will break all these great stories that for us, which is awesome. And then, you know, we have our writer Tessa, who's really great at genetics, and Mike is our physics expert. And then Pete, who's our deputy editor, he's also like this amazing sort of social science, technology, futurism kind of writer. So yeah, we've actually naturally found quite a good balance. But we do, it's kind of an asset. Sometimes you're interviewing someone and they'll be like, oh yeah, I've done a degree in X. And you're like, oh, okay, that's good. We're short on that on the team.
Yeah, that's funny. And you said that the pandemic hadn't really changed your day-to-day operations because I guess a certain amount of your work was already remote, but how has it affected kind of the reporting focus? Obviously, you've had to cover pandemic-related content and vaccine-related content probably more than you had in other years. How all in did you guys go into the pandemic once it kicked off?
Yeah, that was actually a big discussion for us at the beginning, and it was a hard, you know, we found ourselves, we were reporting on the pandemic right from the start. We actually, I think it's today, we had our 1 year anniversary of the first story we wrote about this mystery virus emerging in China. And we, you know, as no one expected it, I mean, I'm sure Bill Gates maybe expected it, but none of us expected it to blow up as it did. And at the beginning, we were kind of covering everything, like daily case numbers. And we had to kind of work out what we wanted to cover, how hard we wanted to go into it. And Signe especially led this, our managing editor, made the editorial decision to stay science alert, to obviously cover the pandemic. But we just decided, like, you know, we're a niche site and we do science well, but we are not the place people are going to come for their daily numbers. It'll be their local paper, where depending on where they are in the world, or it'll be the New York Times, or it'll be, you know, I felt like a lot of publications were doing case numbers and WHO announcements really well. So we decided to focus on the scientific side of things and kind of keep it to two or three stories a day, so it didn't and continue to cover other science news. That was our like sort of wheelhouse, because I know that a lot of our competitors went like all in and stopped covering any other science news, which I think had short-term benefits, but we wanted to make sure that people who are fatigued on the news and didn't want to read about COVID, because that was also a big part of the population, could come to Science Alert. And that's always been our kind of, not motto, but we love to be like a safe place where people can leave feeling educated and feel good about themselves. And which doesn't mean we only cover positive news, of course. There's a lot of negative stuff we have to cover. But we really didn't want it to be a place where you came and it was like, oh, 10,000 deaths today and, you know, and a million new cases. And we wanted to sort of add intelligent discourse and like useful tips, science back tips and stuff. So yeah, we really picked carefully what we covered and tried to not just add to the noise, but tried to kind of inform and give a little bit of context and hopefully help people navigate the situation better, but also give them some other cool science to read if they did not want to read about the pandemic and they were totally done with it.
Yeah, and has your team come away and found a metric that best represents the spread of the pandemic. Because, for example, there's tests that have been given out, vaccines delivered, deaths, total number of people who've contracted the virus. But there's also some confusion in these types of metrics. Like, for example, the more testing you run, the more cases of infection you're probably going to find. So I think it's been hard for the media to agree on what the underlying metric is. Have you guys all thought about what that might be?
We thought about it. We don't report regularly with the same metric, but often in our discussions when we're talking about whether something is worthy of noting, a metric that we often discuss is like the number of tests versus infection rate and that percentage. So, you know, if you're doing 1,000 tests and you find one case, that's more significant than if you've done 1,000,000 tests and you find one case. So making sure we refer back to the number of tests that are being done to give that context sort of has been really important for us. But we don't actually have a standard for that, but we do talk about it a lot and we try to make sure that we sort of give the bigger picture and make sure that, and if we talk about deaths, we refer to like how many cases there were overall and what the survival rate is versus the death rate and that kind of thing to keep it all into perspective.
And are you doing a lot of reporting on the vaccine rollout?
We have been. Again, it's hard because a lot of that delves into getting quite sort of business and political reporting almost, because a lot of it's, you know, state, it's all state by state, right? And it's hard. You know, we've reported on all the research and all the trials that have gone up to date and how it's being rolled out and what that means, but we haven't, we don't report daily on like, this state's doing this right now, this state's launching this. So we're trying to keep that bigger picture view and keep a little more global in the focus. But yeah, that's been something super interesting. And we're doing a story at the moment this morning. We're putting something up on how the latest, the South African variant, the more contagious variant that's spreading now, some of the early concerns about how that might respond to the vaccine. I mean, it's too soon to know, but scientists have some concerns. So we definitely cover that news.
Yeah, and that was something I wanted to dive into with you actually, is there's a lot of kind of anti-vax sentiment out there even before the pandemic. And then here we do have a vaccine that was in some ways rushed and the fastest vaccine we've ever had. How are you guys thinking about reporting on this? Because I would imagine that this is kind of an area that you guys dance around very carefully when discussing the vaccine, because obviously on some level as scientists, you want to encourage people to take the vaccine, but on another level, you have to distinguish between the different vaccines and make it clear to readers that this vaccine hasn't gone through the normal process. So what is the kind of dance and caution that you guys feel when reporting on vaccines right now?
We just kind of try to stick to the facts and keep it very neutral, because even though it has been rushed through, these vaccines actually have gone through the same trials that any vaccine would. It's just because they had this emergency kind of rushed process that it's happened a lot faster. But it honestly has been not that out of, like, you know, when you go through all the phase 1, phase 2, phase 3 trials that they've done, and the timelines they've looked at, it's really very similar to what most vaccines would go through. Obviously, we just don't have that legacy data to be like, you know, 3 years down the track, this happens. But most vaccines, you know, when they're there'll be longer term studies, but often they'll be approved after a sort of, you know, trials that last for 6 to 9 months, that kind of thing. But we just really try to not encourage anyone to do anything, and just report on the facts and people can make their own minds up. I think that obviously we would never misrepresent if anything hasn't gone through the proper checks or it's too early to be, you know, given or to, you know, to be used as a drug or a treatment or a vaccine, we would obviously report on that. But anything that has gone through the proper trials, we'll just give. And we also, I don't know if you've seen this on the site, but something that's really important to us is that we source like the actual published peer review paper in every article we write. So, you know, making sure that we give people access to all that data so they can also make their own minds up and we can report on that as well. But it is a tricky space to navigate. And I totally, you know, I feel really confident. I've looked at the research into the vaccines and the safety, and I'm going to get it when I can, and I feel confident in that. But I understand why people are wary, because it does feel super rushed if you don't understand, or not don't understand, that sounds condescending, not don't understand, but if you're not super familiar with the scientific process and the trials that these drugs go through, it does feel like, you know, how come we don't have a vaccine for this and we have a vaccine for this? But you know, pretty much any health researcher in the vaccine space really went heads down and focused on this virus, which isn't something that usually happens. There's not like all the researchers in the world that focus on one thing. They've had like in the sort of expedited trial approvals that would never, normally it takes months or years to get a clinical trial approved. So these guys have had their trials rushed through, but the trials themselves have been really solid and really standard to what you'd normally have. So I think that's promising. And I think it happened a lot faster than I thought, in a good way. I was really kind of wowed by the global science collective effort here that's happened in getting some of these vaccines. And I just hope that, you know, when we see some big changes to the infection numbers and stuff over the coming months as a result.
Yeah, and one of the things you just mentioned actually is that you try to just provide the facts for readers and let them make their own conclusions. And I think a lot of news outlets say that this is what they're doing. But actually, one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the podcast was that Science Alert is one of the outlets that is on Kreder's leaderboard. And I think you're actually the first CEO the first CEO from any outlet that's made it to our leaderboard. And so with this opportunity, I actually wanted to examine what it is about your process of putting the pieces together, or maybe having a certain level of peer review within the staff. I really want you to kind of walk me through the entire process from deciding what story somebody is going to cover and going out and collecting interviews and sources and doing the research, all the way to what is worthy of making it to publication. And I, again, call that out because you're currently number 14 on Kreder's outlet leaderboard. I'm sure you guys will keep moving up because the readers have been responding really well. But I'm sure it has a lot to do with this idea that you really are just trying to put out the facts in a kind of clear, chronological, easy to understand way, and not trying to input the author's perspective or bias or viewpoint into the pieces. But please walk me through kind of conception of a story idea all the way to publication.
Yeah, so my managing editor, Signe, who I mentioned before, has really driven this process. So I have to credit her, because I'll walk you through the process, because I still edit 1 week a month, as I knew before. But yeah, this is totally her brainchild. Her and Pete, the deputy editor, have kind of come up with this. So I take no credit. They are, I'm really lucky to have such amazing, kind of really skeptical, hardline science editors who have put this in place. But yeah, basically we have our writers pitch stories, and we have quite a strict pitching process where the story either has to be published in a peer review journal, or it has to be, you know, maybe an early access preprint publication, but for a very good reason, and it can't be any kind of health advice in a preprint publication. We wouldn't run that. We also would cover news, like cool news that's happening, you know, maybe like with the strange kind of monolith that was found. Like we'll cover some fun stuff like that, but you know, when it comes to actual science, you know, breaking science, it has to be peer reviewed. And we also have to flag in the pitch the sample size of the study, and give a little more, and like whether it was in mice, whether it was in the lab, whether it was in humans. So I think from the from kickoff, it's all a very like focus process. We can't just sort of pitch any random like thing we've seen on Reddit that's interesting. It really has to have the facts to back it up. And then the editor of the day will assign the writer's stories based on what they find the most interesting and the most credible and the most important to report on. And then the writers go off and write. We always have to have the full journal article, the full peer review journal article. So like no writer can write an article without that. That's just our black and white policy. We don't always do original interviews. We definitely do if it's kind of a big story or like, you know, a little bit of a controversial story or something that when, you know, maybe a cool new, like a viral, we've done some cool stories on like a viral photo of a bat that's, you know, all over Facebook. And then we've talked to a like an animal expert about what that bat actually is. So I think probably like 60% of the time we don't run original interviews. We'll just get quotes from the press release, from the journal article, or maybe a few email quotes. But then 40% of the time we'll kind of be going out and calling the scientist or emailing them and getting some more feedback. And if it's a particularly contentious story, we'll get like a third independent person's quote to kind of give us a little bit more perspective on that. Someone who's in the field but hasn't worked on the paper. So it kind of, it depends on the story. Sometimes there are some pretty straightforward ones, but we definitely, our writers are very kind of skeptical and we'll look at it with a pretty hard eye. We don't really oversell, they're trained not to oversell stuff. Then the story gets filed and our fact checkers will go through each one and they're independent. So basically the fact checker isn't the writer and it isn't the editor of the story. So there will be like this person who's just looking at the facts and they'll go through the paper and make sure all the numbers match up. They'll make sure the claims aren't oversold. And really their job is just to like poke holes in it, find anything wrong, find any claims that are a bit dubious. Once they've added all, and you know, they usually have quite a few suggestions. Even if it's not errors, they might be like, yeah, I'd probably rephrase that, make it a little softer. They add all their comments in like a Google Doc, and then the editor will go in, kind of incorporate them, and then give it the editorial kind of over, polish, and also put it a little, like make sure it's in Science Flip style. So we have a pretty, as you said before, we have like a pretty lively, energetic voice. We're excited about science. We want to be informative, but we try and keep things very clear. Our whole thing is not to be jargony. Like if you haven't studied science, you should be able to come to the site and still learn a cool thing. And we really try and structure it. So like you could read the first half of the article if you're not super into science and get a basic overview of the facts and the study and the sample size and go, okay, cool, I can tell my friends about this, this is great. But if you are like a science lover or you studied that topic, you could then keep reading and dive a little deeper in and maybe find out about some of the other papers that are related and that kind of thing. And so once that's done, the editor will also put a headline on the story, and then that also gets fact-checked after the fact. So there's another step where we kind of have the headline. And obviously, you know, that's a hard thing in all media, but it's really hard in science. It's such a fine line because you want your headlines to be compelling. You want to sell the coolest part of the story. You want to make people click, of course, because we're an ad-funded publication. So you do want people to click, but you really can't oversell and you can't mislead. We use the term internally, the phrase internally, clickbait with a happy ending, where sometimes, I mean, we also try not to use clickbait as much as we can, but sometimes there's a story where you're like, oh, a knowledge gap here really works. This is really cool. But you want to make sure that when people do click, they get the answer that's sort of been promised to them in the headline and that it's interesting and they leave feeling good. They're not like, oh, I clicked that and that was a waste of time. But they leave and like, oh yeah, that was cool. So and then once it's been checked off by the fact checker, the headline, it's pretty much ready to go. So we'll make it alive, and that's the process.
And I wouldn't have brought this up, but I'm glad you did. Can you speak to our listeners a little bit about the monolith that was found? Was that found in Utah?
Yeah, it was in Utah, and then all these replicas popped up all over the world. I actually did not cover that story, so I'm not an expert on the monolith, but I'm pretty sure it was, you know, an artist or a set piece or something, not an alien. I mean, there are some weird things that have been found, and that was pretty weird, but I also feel like it was pretty explainable. I'm sure, you know, that could have been quite explainable, someone having some fun there.
Do you think that there's any compelling evidence about aliens in general? I mean, we have a lot of different former military people coming out and saying some interesting things these days. And a lot of the UFO label is, it really is meant to be for things that just aren't identified. And there are lots of different unidentified things that were the US Navy and Air Force are finding, as well as other countries. Do you think that there's kind of more digging that credible journalists should be doing in this area?
It's really hard. I agree with you. Yeah, unidentified flying objects, there are a lot, and there are a lot of things that people don't quite know what they are, and I think that's worthy of study by researchers. And I haven't seen any evidence that there's any kind of cover up of people who know more than they're saying. I think that I don't think that journalists need to dig in, but of course, that's journalists' job to dig in. And I think if anyone sees any compelling hook there, they should go for it. But the universe is such a big place. I would find it super strange if we were the only intelligent life forms in the whole universe. I do think the more I've learned about, because as I said, I didn't have a space background, but I've actually become a little bit of a space buff since editing all these cool space stories. And the more I learn about space, it's just so far, it's so vast and so expensive in terms of resources to travel and human life to travel in space, that I'm sure that when, I mean, I'm not sure, but I would find it highly unlikely that we're alone in the universe as intelligent life forms. But I would find it also very unlikely that at this exact point of time in the lifespan of the universe, there is another intelligent life form that is able to overcome the vast challenges of space travel to get to us, or potentially even contact us. So yeah, I don't know how likely it is that we will find an intelligent civilization in our lifetime. Maybe find traces of it, but potentially not be able to contact it. I mean, you've probably seen a lot of NASA scientists now are pretty convinced that like within the next 30 years, we'll be able to find some evidence of intelligent life out there somewhere, or microbial life, or some evidence of life outside of Earth. And yeah, I feel like that's, I would not be totally shocked if that happened. We also have a joke at Science Lit that like, we have a weekend editor, but we have like a bank of stories and we'll put up a few new ones, but it's always like just every Friday it's like, but yeah, just call us if they find aliens. So we can't, yeah, I feel like it could happen. I wouldn't be totally surprised, but I don't think that from what I've seen, I don't think that the UFO footage and all the stuff that's been declassified recently by the Navy is that, I don't think they are, that's evidence of aliens. I do think it's probably some other cool, weird, atmospheric phenomena that we're not aware of that's worth investigating further. But I don't think, for me personally, I don't think that's evidence of aliens.
Yeah, okay. And I agree with you. I think it's just a matter of maybe even weeks, months, or years now before we have some kind of reading or signal, whether from far off distant planets and galaxies or maybe even closer. But I think that it's worth the human kind of consciousness to start trying to mentally prepare themselves for some level of contact.
Absolutely. And I do think there is slightly, I mean, it's changing, but I remember when I was first working at Science Lit and we'd cover any stories that, we'd be like, oh, this is an alien signal or whatever. But anything that could sound a little alien-y, people would be like, oh, that's so unscientific. Like, why would you even be reporting on that? That's sci-fi. And I think it's slowly changing where actually a lot of really, really talented and intelligent and reputable scientists are actually focusing on this. There's organizations like SETI, parts of NASA. We're literally on Mars at the moment digging with a rover to look for signs of alien life out there. So I think people should wrap their heads around the fact that we could find evidence that we're not alone. I don't think that we're going to be visited or visiting aliens anytime soon, unfortunately, but that would be pretty cool. But yeah, I don't think that's going to be happening just because of how big space is. But yeah, I really think that it will only be a matter of time before we find some compelling evidence out there, which is so exciting. I mean, our job as science journalists, I feel really lucky. I mean, there are challenges of being a science journalist, but I feel like it's the coolest field because, yeah, I've been doing this like, what, 15, 16 years now, and we've been at the, like, being able to do live updates, live vlogs, reporting on some of the coolest things. Like, we all, the whole team, because we're in Australia, we all were up at like 4 a.m. or something ridiculous when they unveiled the first image of a black hole with the Event Horizon telescope, and we're all crying together on Slack. And I don't know, like some of those moments, and when they announced the discovery of the gravitational waves, like being, it's really cool that in our jobs, as hard as it can be sometimes, you're at the forefront of that. And yeah, I would be very excited to be up at 2 a.m. on the day that they announce some kind of detection of, you know, an intelligence civilization signal or something.
And what's the most exciting breakthrough or scientific story out there for you personally right now?
Oh, I mean, honestly, the COVID-19 vaccine is very exciting, as much as some people are resisting, you know, or a little wary of it, which I totally get. But I think that that is very cool because it's, you know, it shows when the scientific community works together to kind of take on a global problem, what they can do. I wish that maybe there was more of that focus on things like climate change. I think that would be really cool. But the most exciting thing at the moment, I still think we're finding some really cool research, you know, with gravitational waves. So obviously the discovery of detection of gravitational waves is huge, but you know, we've covered quite a few breakthroughs this year, you know, understanding more about the expansion of the universe and missing matter and that kind of thing with gravitational waves. And I've also really loved following our understanding of fast radio bursts. I don't know if you're familiar with those. Those are the signals that, like, I guess people, especially, I think I first reported on fast radio bursts in like 2008, and they were like potentially an alien signal back then because they were these unexplainable like flashes. I think it's something like 1,000 times the energy of the sun in like a second, like flashes out through the galaxy or the universe, and no one knew what they were. And in the time that I've reported on them, and then the team's been reporting on them, and I've sort of edited some stories, we've gone from being like, maybe it's aliens, these are crazy, to, you know, being able to narrow down where they came from with the amazing telescopes and the scientists all focusing in on them, and kind of mixing radio telescopes and visible telescopes. And they've been able to find out where they come from. They found fast radio bursts coming from our own galaxy this year. They found repeating fast radio bursts. And they're getting really close to understanding what they are. So that's really, really cool.
Do you have any thoughts on the importance of us becoming multiplanetary? Obviously, you follow the space industry, which includes SpaceX and Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic, which is more of the kind of space tourism, though. But do you have any strong feelings about the need to become multiplanetary?
Yeah, I think that, yeah, personally, not speaking for science a lot, but just myself, I think it's going to be important. Unfortunately, I would love if we could confidently, you know, take care of our own planet and feel like this would be home for a very long time. But at the same time, I think exploring space, whether it's to escape Earth because we've, you know, killed it with climate change or waste or, you know, pollution or whatever it is, that's one thing. But I think just getting off our planet and seeing what else is out there and exploring new planets, exploring new worlds is important for, I think, you know, the progression of society, and hopefully it would help humans realize a little more that we are all on this planet together. It's not so, things don't need to be so divided and geopolitical and things like that. You know, we really are the same species on this one planet, and maybe if we start traveling to other planets, we might have a little more perspective. I think that people talk a lot about the kind of astronaut effect. Once you've seen Earth from space, there's this like moment where a lot of astronauts are like, oh, I just get it now. We're so small. We're so, you know, we're so dependent on each other. Why, like all these conflicts and all the politics, it's really crazy. And so, yeah, I think that getting that perspective and going to other planets is great. And it's also, you know, some people will, as I kind of said at the start, yeah, like, why are we going to space if we can't take care of Earth? There's a lot of criticism around that. And although I do think we could maybe do a little better at taking care of Earth, I do think space travel is super important, not only for giving us perspective and for advancing many other scientific fields. I mean, so many inventions that we use on Earth in medicine and things have come from space travel and that industry. But I think it also is just something beautiful that humans can celebrate together. There's something really inspiring, even, you know, what, like just watching a rocket launch is something really beautiful. I watch it with my daughter who's 3.5, and like she doesn't even know where the mission, well, she'll understand a little bit, but she won't know where the mission's going or what's happening or why it's so important. But like that countdown and the rocket launching, she gets so excited. And I feel like some of the rocket launches this year, I don't know if you saw, but there were like three missions to Mars that have launched sort of in that July period. And they were particularly emotional because these scientists have worked to launch these missions all via Slack and Zoom, all remotely, all like wearing masks in the command center. And it's such a changed world with COVID. But the fact that scientists can still come together and like have these huge, ambitious missions, yeah, I think it's really important. I think if we, you know, if we didn't have that to sort of look to the future and discover unknown things, and it would be, we'd be worse off for it.
Yeah, you mentioned what the astronauts refer to as the overview effect, which is a personal dream of mine to someday experience the concept of being outside into space and looking back on our planet and having that perspective, that realization that, oh my God, we're alone. Nobody's gonna come to rescue us. Not the aliens, not anybody. We have to be able to work together and figure out our problems. And one thing that I've noticed is that there's been a lot of kind of crowd anger towards some of these space tourism businesses that are emerging. But my thoughts are that if the overview effect really is one of the most life-changing perspective shifts somebody can have, well, then maybe it's a good thing, a net benefit to all of society, if the most rich and powerful people get up there and look back on Earth and start to realize when they come back home that they need to be doing more. And then you brought up also the climate change. So let's go local now. Science Alert is based in Australia. This year started out with the fires in Australia, which quickly became, no offense, a secondary news story of the year. But how did those fires, how is that situation developing? Are there still live fires now? What are the effects that are on the ground?
Yeah, well, Australia is very big. So we actually do have fires at the moment, but I'm on the East Coast. I'm just an hour north of Sydney near the beach. So we had the fires like November 2019. So it was the summer of last year. We're in summer now. And it was last year was intense. I mean, it's been such a surreal year with COVID and everything. And we just had Christmas. And we were remembering, like, God, I just remember last Christmas not being able to, we couldn't go outside for days. We had to roll wet towels under the door because the smoke was so bad. And my closest fire was 15 kilometers or something. So they were getting a little close, but not that close. And it was still like, you could barely see the other side of the road. It was so, so smoky. And I'm sure, you know, California and Washington and your West Coast have had similar fires. So I'm sure I'm not the only one who knows that feeling, but there's something, you know, that for me was worse than the lockdowns we've had for COVID, because it was so oppressive and you couldn't see and it felt sick all the time because you were breathing all the smoke. So, and then obviously the millions and millions of koalas and wildlife that died and the humans, unfortunately, that lost their lives. You definitely see it. So I'm north of Sydney. We had it earlier on, and then around New Year's Eve and in January, it was the south coast, like going into Victoria, New South Wales to Victoria, that had it really badly. And you can see totally, it is regrowing. We've had a lot of rain on the east coast this year, thankfully. It's been a very rainy summer, which is great. So we've not had any fires on the east coast this summer, and things are growing back. But there's you know, people are still homeless. People have still lost everything. There's totally still effects from it. It's been devastating. And at the political level, you know, nothing has really changed. You know, like the government is still funding new coal plants, and it's been very frustrating. But yeah, at this summer, so on the West Coast, there are now fires threatening Perth, which is, you know, really far away. It's like a 4-hour flight from here, similar to your coasts. But yeah, we still have flat fires burning. So although the East Coast is doing well, the West Coast is still struggling, and it's only gonna get worse and continue. I mean, the science is super clear. I don't, you know, whether or not people want to believe in human-induced climate change or whatever it is, regardless, we are in a period where the planet is getting hotter and extreme weather events are getting more extreme and more frequent. And so, the really, really horrible fire period we had last summer is probably going to be a lot more common. And similar, you know, I know the States has had a few years in a row now of terrible wildfires. And similarly, you know, pandemics that were like 1 in 100 years, they're predicting are going to be 1 in 50 years or 1 in 20 years. So I do think that, I hope that this year has been a wake up call for a lot of people, and particularly people in power, because I think that a lot of the public is very switched on now. You know, we all, Science Alert readers, there are climate change trolls who don't agree with stuff, but generally most of our readers, like, they want to, they recycle all their plastic, they compost, they do all the right things. What we need now is like systemic change and investment in renewable energy and like no more funding of new digging coal out of the ground and burning it and putting fossil fuels in the air, because I think the science is pretty clear. I mean, renewable energy is already is doing great stuff, and I think, you know, it could totally work for the future. So it's kind of yeah, for me, it's a clear-cut thing. But yes, we're doing okay. No fires over here on this side of the country at the moment. We'll see how WA is going. They're in the midst of it right now. So yeah, fingers crossed.
Yeah, it's just a matter of time before we have a situation where we're dealing with a live fire and a pandemic at the same time. And I mean, Australia kind of had that this year, but with a little bit of a breather in between.
Yeah, exactly.
So I have two questions that I ask every guest at the end of every podcast. But before I get to those, can you give listeners where they should go to follow you and your work as well as Science Alert?
Yeah, so please, I am on Twitter. I'm Fiona J. McDonald, MAC. You can follow me. I don't tweet that much anymore, but I used to tweet a lot. And I still tweet sometimes. But you can get in touch with me there. I check it if you want to message me. And Science Alert is sciencealert.com. And we're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. All at Science Alert. We're also on TikTok. We're the real Science Alert, I think, on TikTok. But we're pretty much anywhere that you are, hopefully. And yeah, we'd love you to check out the site.
Great. And my last two questions for you here. Question number one is Bitcoin. Are you a believer? Not so much? Never heard of it? What do you think?
I wouldn't say I'm a believer. I have invested a little bit in Bitcoin, but very lightly. I am a believer in cryptocurrencies in general. I'm sure that in the future, it just makes sense. Like, it's a very intelligent system. I don't know if it's going to be Bitcoin or Ethereum or Ripple or, like, you know, I don't know what the system will be, but I do think it's a smart way of banking. And a lot of banks are already using, you know, some of the methods. So I am a believer in cryptocurrencies, but I'm not a diehard, you know, hold Bitcoin person.
Okay, great. And last question for you here today is, are we living in a simulation?
I don't know. I don't think anyone knows. I, you know, as a curious scientist, I would not put anything past us. I know we did a story a few years ago that there was like some evidence that we could be living in a simulation. I have no idea, but nothing surprises me anymore, potentially. I like to think though that, you know, one of the coolest things I've learned in my time working at Science Alert is that we do have more control over, maybe not our lives in the simulation, if that's the case, but over our mindset and over ourselves and over our happiness. You know, that's one of the really cool things. When you read a lot of scientific research, so much of it shows that, you know, the little things, it sounds a little, you know, it sounds silly to say, but, you know, being present and being grateful and focusing on the positives, and even kind of reminiscing on your past in a positive way can really shape your brain. So I think that even if we may not have control over the simulation, we have control over our own kind of realities a little bit more than people think.
Okay, great. Well, Fiona, thank you for coming on this episode of the Credit Podcast. I hope our listeners go and follow you and your work at Science Alert, because the people on Credit have spoken. They love the way you're putting together these articles. Maybe it's beneficial that you have this science focus, and so therefore it's a little less political, a little less partisan games going on in the articles. But whatever you're doing, it's working. Credit hopes to be a platform that allows you to go and demonstrate provably to others that what you're doing is working. So keep it up, and listeners, go check out Science Alert. And Fiona, thank you again for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Chase.
Take care.
Bye.